Today is Wednesday, June 30th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. warns of punitive actions against Ethiopia and Eritrea.
The government's announcement of a cessation of hostilities does not result in improvements, and the situation continues to worsen. Ethiopia and Eritrea should anticipate further actions.
Plus, Amnesty International accuses China of rights abuses in Hong Kong. Also, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un slams officials over COVID infections. Our top story today is in the U.S. A senior U.S. State Department official on Tuesday warned that Ethiopia and Eritrea should anticipate further actions from the administration if the announcement of cessation of hostilities does not result in improvements in the Tigray region. The developments marked a dramatic turn in a conflict that has killed thousands of people, displaced more than 2 million, and pushed hundreds of thousands to the brink of famine. Robert Godech, acting Assistant Secretary of State for the State Department's Bureau of African Affairs, said Washington welcomed the Ethiopian government's decision to declare a temporary end to hostilities, but warned that the United States will watch closely to determine whether the ceasefire results in changes on the ground.
The government's announcement of a cessation of hostilities does not result in improvements, and the situation continues to worsen. Ethiopia and Eritrea should anticipate further actions. We will not stand by in the face of horrors in Tigray. At the same time, we continue to emphasize to the governments of Addis Ababa and Asmara that another path is possible. We stand ready to work with them in ending the humanitarian suffering, resolving the conflict, and renewing momentum towards economic and political reforms. We urge them to make the right choices for the people. We will watch closely to determine if the ceasefire results in changes on the ground. But the Ethiopian government's decision to declare a temporary end to hostilities is a promising development, and we welcome it. It is essential now that all parties commit to the ceasefire, allow humanitarian access, protect civilians, there be independent investigations into atrocities, and that there is justice for victims. Ethiopia is at a pivot point, at an inflection point. What the parties do now matters, determine whether there is a better future ahead for Ethiopia.
That's Robert Godech, acting Assistant Secretary of State for the State Department's Bureau of African Affairs. An Ethiopian government spokesman on Wednesday said the Federal Army could re-enter the Tigray region capital of Mekele within weeks if needed. He also said that government's allied Eritrean forces had withdrawn from the region. Tigrayan forces have said they forced the national military out of Mekele and have moved to seize control of areas beyond the capital. Some regional experts say the news that Ethiopian federal forces are withdrawing from Mekele, the capital of the Tigray region, and that the federal government has declared a ceasefire does not necessarily mean the fighting is completely over. Ali Verji is a researcher for the United States Institute of Peace specializing in East Africa. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about the implication of the ceasefire. They started a conversation about what led up to it.
There are two contrary narratives. One is that the ferocity of the Tigrayan forces' actions has prompted the federal government to resort to a ceasefire. The second is that the federal government had been planning this, recognizing the humanitarian situation is deteriorating and something needed to be done. I think the truth is probably a combination of the two, but it's worth noting that only a week ago, the federal government was still conducting air raids, and so it does seem that the military might of the Tigrayan opposition has precipitated the exact date of this announcement, if not necessarily that it was coming.
Now, is it likely to help bring some degree of peace and stability to Ethiopia, particularly in the Tigray region?
In Tigray itself, there are still areas where the federal government forces are in control, and the Tigrayan forces have said that they want to remove them, and so we could still anticipate that there may be fighting to come in some parts of Tigray. Clearly in areas where the federal government's forces have withdrawn entirely, there is the prospect that there will be less fighting. We still don't know what will happen with the allied forces, both from the Amhara region that have been in Tigray, as well as the Eritrean forces, what their intentions are. But elsewhere in Ethiopia, this will have very little effect on the security situation there, and the country remains consumed by many challenges, by many security issues in other parts of the country as well.
Now, finally, sir, are there any regional implications for other countries surrounding the Horn, Sudan, Somalia, Eritrea?
Clearly, the Eritrean forces have been pivotal in this conflict, and we don't yet know whether the forces will remain. The Ethiopian government has said several times that they will be withdrawn. We haven't yet seen evidence of that. It's clear that the Eritrean government has no love lost for the Tigrayan forces, and so it'll be a very difficult pill for them to swallow to accept that they remain or have retained control or regain control. And elsewhere, it seems possible that part of what has accounted for the resurgence of the Tigrayan forces has been support from Sudan, or at least some material crossing that border. It's difficult to be sure of that, but it does seem that there is also a clear interest for the Sudanese government, or at least part of the Sudanese government, to support forces that are opposed to the government of Abiy Ahmed. So there are clearly regional implications to this, and the humanitarian implications are also regional as well. Just because the fighting has stopped doesn't solve the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are in need of assistance, are facing hunger, and will continue to face that challenge and may be forced to either continue to move into other parts of the country or indeed across borders.
That's Ali Verdi, a researcher for the United States Institute of Peace, speaking with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson from London. Hong Kong authorities have used the new national security law to curb dissent and justify censorship, harassment, and arrests, Amnesty International said in a report on Wednesday, 1 year after the law was implemented. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
1 year after a sweeping national security law was introduced in Hong Kong, Amnesty International has called the situation a human rights emergency. In their report released on Wednesday, Amnesty's regional director in Southeast Asia, Joshua Rosenzweig, pointed to a list of court decisions and interviews with activists that show the law has been used to target dissent, justify censorship and arrests.
There does seem to be a political element to this, where there's some of these charges and prosecutions appear to be politically motivated and designed to curb political opposition and silence voices that the government doesn't want.
Beijing imposed the national security law to punish anything it deems as subversion, secession, colluding with foreign forces and terrorism, with up to life in prison. Authorities have said the law would affect an extremely small minority of people and that it had restored stability after months of often violent protests in 2019. According to a Reuters tally, more than 100 people have been arrested and more than 60 charged in the first year under the new law. Amnesty has sounded the alarm and said the actions under the law, including harassment and prosecutions, violate human rights.
You know, we're calling on the United Nations, particularly the Human Rights Council, but also the High Commissioner for Human Rights, to really look into the way in which national security, terrorism, and these other concepts are being used by the Chinese government more broadly to target and limit the enjoyment of human rights.
The Hong Kong government did not immediately respond to requests for comment.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin on Wednesday said Amnesty International's statement on the Hong Kong national security law was, quote, purely malicious slander, unquote. Authorities have said the law would affect an, quote, extremely small minority, unquote, of people, and that it had restored stability after months of often violent protests in 2019. They have said rights and freedom in the former British colony remain protected, but they are not absolute. International human rights groups are voicing growing concern over Turkey's increasing practice of abducting people from abroad who are accused of terrorism offenses. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
A Turkish news channel broadcasts images of Selahattin Gülen handcuffed and paraded in front of a Turkish flag. Gülen was spirited out of Kenya in May by Turkish intelligence forces. He's accused of being a member of the FETÖ group, which Turkish authorities allege was behind a failed coup in 2016. Turkish officials accused Gülen's uncle, Fethullah, of being the ringleader of the coup. The older Gülen denies involvement. Earlier in June, the US-based Human Rights Watch strongly criticized Turkey's increasing use of international rendition or the handing over of accused persons from other countries. Emma Sinclair Webb of Human Rights Watch told VOA fundamental legal practices are being undermined.
These are not extraditions. These are far more like renditions, where you capture the individual concerned and you bypass courts and legal frameworks and bring that person forcibly back to Turkey. And the concern here is that you are unlawfully disregarding these men's asylum claims, citizenship in countries where they've been based for many years.
This year, a report from the democracy advocacy group Freedom House claimed Turkey had rendered people from at least 31 countries. Most of those taken are accused of belonging to the group Ankara blames for the coup attempt. Separately, relatives of a Turkish teacher in Kyrgyzstan allege he was abducted by Turkey, a charge Ankara denies. The scale of the Turkish operations is a sign of the increasing assertiveness and global reach of Turkey, says Sezin Öner, columnist for the Duvar news portal.
For a while, Turkey was using its soft power, but now it's using this newfound diplomatic and foreign influence in much more hardcore ways, especially intelligence-wise, as in the case of renditions.
Ankara is vowing to continue implementing this policy. In an attempt to deflect criticism, Turkish officials claim the United States used the same practice during its war on terrorism earlier in the 2000s. Professor Alexander Kuli, director of Columbia University's Harriman Institute in New York, says Turkey is likely to be encouraged because it has faced little international criticism, which he says has worrying consequences.
There is no pushback from the international community that the Turkish government is conducting these operations either in tacit collaboration or informal collaboration with security services abroad, and there has been very little pushback from the international community. The implications are that it becomes a more and more accepted practice, this breach of humanitarian norms and this fundamental abuse of human rights.
Ankara says it remains committed to tracking down those it calls its enemies and bringing them to justice, warning they will not find sanctuary anywhere. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
In Nigeria, video has surfaced showing Boko Haram militants pledging loyalty to the Islamic State West African Province, or ISWAP, group. It comes just weeks after Boko Haram's leader was reportedly killed in a battle with ISWAP. Nigerian security experts say the video shows that ISWAP could be consolidating control of the country's terrorist insurgency. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The 13-minute-long video shows fighters from both factions chanting in solidarity. Soon afterward, the Boko Haram fighters pledged their support for the newly appointed ISWAP commander, known as Khalifa Muslimai, meaning the leader of all Muslims. A Nigerian military spokesperson was not immediately available to comment, but security expert Senator Irebu says a fusion of both groups could mean more lethal attacks.
They have now ability to concentrate their energy. There'll be consolidation of leadership, consolidation of resources, consolidation of intelligence, which will be even more difficult for Nigerian states to deal with, because then they have two. When they had two factions, you could easily infiltrate an ability to work one against the other.
Boko Haram and ISWAP have been clashing for control of territory for many years. Boko Haram is known to hold larger bases in northeastern Nigeria's Borno and Adamawa states. In May, the group's leader, Abubakar Shekau, reportedly blew up himself in order to avoid capture by ISWAP, although it must be noted that Shekau has been reported dead many times before. Darlington Abdullahi, a retired high-ranking Air Force officer, says ISWAP will likely take control of more areas, but says the rivalry between the groups is not over.
They are tested, more tested, because they are coming from an environment, I mean, that they've been at war, even with the very strong and other very strong nations. So the battle between the two groups will actually still continue for some time. But on the whole, it feels that there's more danger for the livelihood, the lives of people around generally.
Abdullahi says government security forces must act without delay or there will be repercussions.
At this stage is when all elements, all force should be brought against them, because they are still trying to find their footing and try to get other elements of Boko Haram into their fold.
ISWAP is known for often targeting the military and easily recruiting civilians from communities. Experts fear that ISWAP's reign will make the Islamist insurgency much more difficult to control and set back years of progress. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
This is the Voice of America. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Wednesday that a U.S. reconnaissance aircraft was operating in sync with the British destroyer during last week's Black Sea incident in what he described as a, quote, provocation, unquote, to test Moscow's response. Russia said its forces fired towards the British ship. The British military said that did not happen. Israeli officials say the government has reached a compromise with Jewish settlers who rapidly established an unauthorized outpost in the occupied West Bank last month. Under the agreement, the settlers will leave by the end of the week. The area will become a closed military zone, but the houses and roads will remain in place. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says a, quote, grave incident, unquote, has threatened his country's coronavirus prevention efforts. It is a rare admission by Pyongyang, which claims to be free of COVID-19. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
A meeting in Pyongyang, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un scolded senior officials for unspecified carelessness related to the pandemic. He said the situation has caused a grave incident that poses a huge crisis to the safety of the nation. State media provided no details about the incident or how it posed a threat. North Korea continues to insist it has found zero cases of COVID-19. It's not clear whether Wednesday's admission reflects any wider change in approach toward the virus, or if it was a pretext for other plans. State media said several senior officials were replaced during the Politburo meeting. Some analysts say it may have been an excuse for a leadership purge. Young Moo-jin, a Seoul-based North Korea expert, says he expects North Korea's lockdown to continue long after other countries declare the pandemic over. That is in part because North Korea has rejected international efforts to provide COVID-19 vaccines. North Korea has been in a severe lockdown since January 2020. An outbreak in North Korea could be extremely dangerous because many parts of the country are impoverished and lack an adequate health care system. In a report last week, the World Health Organization said North Korea claimed it had conducted more than 31,000 COVID-19 tests, all of which, it says, came back negative. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
European borders and economies are opening this summer thanks to falling coronavirus cases and rising vaccination numbers. But experts warn the pandemic scars could be long-term and profound, especially for young people, a generation Europe cannot afford to lose. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has this story from Paris.
Things are looking up for young Parisians. Bars and restaurants have reopened. Also schools and universities for the last weeks before summer vacations. At a community room with other students, Sorbonne University student Catalina Mack is studying for final exams. She's grateful that months of coronavirus confinement are over.
C'est très compliqué de rester tout le temps chez soi.
With France's rolling lockdowns, Max says, it was difficult and stressful to be alone all day in front of the computer. Like other students in France, she spent most of her academic year taking online classes from home. Experts point to multiple ways the crisis has and continues to hit Europe's youth, causing economic, social, and mental distress. Many, like Mac, already live on the edge. Shuttered businesses, especially in sectors like hospitality, wiped out job opportunities on which many depend. European Union statistics estimate more than 17% of people under 25 are out of work, more than twice the regional average. Youth poverty and homelessness are on the rise, so is depression. Sarah Coupchou is Europe Studies head for French nonprofit, the Abbé Pierre Foundation. She says there is a segment of Europeans today, including young people, who are merely surviving. With the pandemic and job losses, huge lines of young people have been seeking food and are hungry. A recent report by the charity also explores the growing difficulties Europe's youth face in finding housing. Like many other young Europeans, Mac was too poor to leave home. But she recently managed to find subsidized housing at a building for young students and workers on the edge of Paris. Her apartment has just enough room for a bed, desk, and small kitchen. Dirty dishes are piled high in the sink. The refrigerator is mostly empty. Mac gets student aid and a small government stipend, but it's not enough to live on. Her parents don't always have enough money to help her out. Days of studying alone have also taken a psychological toll. Even before COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, she said, she had problems with stress and suicidal thoughts. It got worse with the pandemic. It was especially stressful not to be able to go to class normally. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Three major investor groups representing some of Australia's biggest finance firms are calling for government regulators to force big companies to disclose how they plan to address financial risks from climate change. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports, the coalition of investors is warning climate change is becoming a major threat to global economy.
In a new report, the group of major investors from Australia and New Zealand is demanding regulators set new standards for companies reporting on how climate change and global warming affect their business and change the value of investments. The authors believe the current voluntary disclosure of climate-related risks is failing to provide investors with confidence. Erwin Jackson is the director of policy at the Investor Group on Climate Change, which contributed to the report.
Essentially what investors are asking companies, are they ready for the impacts of climate change? Are they ready for the transition to net zero emissions? But unfortunately at the moment, the information that investors are getting from companies is really inadequate, and it's not really allowing investors to kick the tires of many companies to see if they're adequate investments in the face of climate risk.
Australia has suffered devastating bushfires in recent years. The 2019-20 bushfire season burned through more than 18 million hectares of land and cost more than $6 billion. The investor group says it's concerned about the long-term impact of bushfires and droughts in Australia. The majority of Australian company chief executives now consider global warming to be a hazard to economic growth. All Australian states and territories have set a target of net zero emissions, but the federal government has yet to commit to such an ambition. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has insisted his environmental policies are responsible and won't damage the economy. Coal still generates most of Australia's electricity, but major retailers, including supermarket giant Woolworths and Telstra, a dominant telecommunications company, have all set ambitious renewable energy targets. Analysts have said that going green was popular with customers and investors, was good for a company's public image, and also made sound financial sense. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofoedu in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.